Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga at Four podcast. Honored again today with return guest, internationally acclaimed Holocaust scholar, Michael Barenbaum. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I can continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below and in the chat. Michael joined us on the show a couple weeks ago to discuss some of the terminology that's been used to compare the Holocaust with the Gaza War. Today, we're going to explore the ideologies of Nazism and radical Islam, how they tie into each other, and how they differ. As a matter of brief introduction, Michael Barenbaum is one of the most internationally renowned Holocaust scholars alive today. A rabbi, professor, and lecturer, Barenbaum's work examines the intersection of historical trauma and contemporary culture. His scholarship has shaped both academic study and public understanding of the Holocaust, and he continues to be a leading voice in the field. You can see his full bio in the description. Michael, thank you so much for coming back to continue this important conversation.
My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us today from Israel, in fact. What a pleasure and an honor. So let's start out when it comes to understanding the ideological crossover between Nazism and Islamism. I think it helps to go back to World War II because not everybody understands the real history. So the Muslim Grand Mufti Al-Husseini of Jerusalem was no stranger to Adolf Hitler, for example. Can you explain the relationship between these two men? The views that they shared or maybe disagreed upon regarding the Jewish people? And can you clear up a matter of historical record that there's a lot of contradictory information about online? Did these two men discuss the final solution?
Okay, let's begin. For Adolf Hitler, the Mufti of Jerusalem was a bit player. The Mufti of Adolf Hitler had, by the time he met with the Mufti of Jerusalem, decided on the final solution to the Jewish problem, and also had decided that the means of implementing the final solution would be gassing. How do we know that? We know that from three pieces of very important evidence. Number one, a instruction to build the first of the death camps, and concentration camps were an imprisonment place where you work the prisoners. Death camp were designed not to work the prisoners, but to murder the prisoners. The instruction to give the to create the first death camp, which is Chelmno, and there's a very important movie now out on Chelmno called "The World Will Tremble," about two escapees from Chelmno who brought the information about what was happening in the death camp. So we know that the instruction was given to Odilo Glubotnik to establish Chelmno before the Hitler and the Mufti met. And we know also that the murder of Jews had been occurring in the occupied Soviet Union from the 22nd of June onward. So these two, and the third piece of evidence is prior to the implementation of the final solution, Germany wanted to get rid of the Jews and therefore allowed the Jews to emigrate. Immigration had stopped and was no longer permitted. Because the final solution was determined, the goal was not to eliminate the Jews from German territory, but to annihilate them, what the Nazis called exterminate. Now, what was the Mufti's interest? The Mufti's interest was less on, he didn't give a damn about the Jews of Europe, but he wanted to get rid of the Zionist enterprise, which was the resettlement of Jews in what was then pre-state Israel, known as Palestine. And consequently, he wanted Hitler to succeed in order to end that immigration to Palestine and to stuff out the Zionist attempts to found a Jewish state before it could possibly be born. So they met, and Hitler considered the Mufti useful, not essential. And in fact, the Prime Minister of Israel made a foolish mistake, especially for the son of a historian, in which he misled himself and a bunch of people, saying that the Mufti had given Hitler the idea for the final solution. And that's why I'm.
Really quickly, when you say the prime minister, what prime minister are you referring to?
Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, made a mistake, and a mistake we hold him responsible for because A, he's prime minister, two, he was the son of a distinguished historian, a Cornell professor who should have known better. He said that the Mufti gave Hitler the idea of gassing when the gassing had been ordered prior to their meeting. So the Mufti wanted to snuff out Zionism and didn't care where the Jews ended up as long as it was not in Palestine. And consequently, he found Hitler useful because he was going to do two things. He was going to eliminate the Jews, and especially the reservoir of Jews in Europe who might migrate to Palestine and create a Jewish state. And the second thing is that Hitler was probably, and he was urging Hitler to attack from Egypt, to attack Palestine itself, and to control and eliminate the Jewish population there. He also instigated, the Mufti instigated a pogrom in Iraq, which
Right.
was the only pogrom in Muslim history, because Jews and Muslims prior to the politicalization, Jews were acceptable to Muslims as people of the book, provided that they knew their place. They had to be subordinate and subservient, but they were in the legal context and protected by law, something that had not occurred for centuries within Christianity itself.
Interesting. That's very interesting. So it sounds, if I could try to summarize it, there seems to be a lot of like sort of nuance here. Would it be accurate to say that the divergence was that Hitler sought to annihilate in murder all the Jews, wherein the Mufti's real vision was just to stop Jews from coming to Israel and perhaps to get them out of the Middle East rather than necessarily murder them?
Let's make it very simple. Hitler wanted to kill all the Jews everywhere. He didn't want a Jew to exist anywhere in the world. The Mufti said, "I don't give a damn whether Jews exist or not, just not in my area, my territory, my land, my place. So whatever happens to them elsewhere is somebody else's problem. It's what we would call NEBY, not in my backyard, not in my area." Hitler, obviously, this is not to compliment the Mufti. It's just that Hitler was more ambitious. He also regarded the Jews as this is the ideology, he regarded the Jews as a cancer. And if you regard Jews as a cancer, let me be graphic, and if I walked in and cut off a woman's left breast, I would be a mutilator. If I'm a doctor and say, "I regret to inform you, but you have a tumor and you need a mastectomy," I'm a healer. So if Hitler regarded the Jews as a cancer, then murdering the Jews, a cancer on German society, then removing them, murdering them, was considered what they call healing by killing. And that was the ideology of total annihilation, healing by killing, because of the way in which the Jews were depicted in Hitler's ideology. There's one other way of looking at it, which is Hitler was interested in survival of the fittest. And Germany, he felt, had to be, and Germans had to be the dominant race. And Judaism itself had taught two things to the world that were against survival of the fittest. One is justice, which means not domination, but as it were, the rule of law. And the other was the notion of compassion or empathy for human beings. And by the way, this is true of Judaism. It's also true of Christianity. And that went against the ideology, the dominant ideology of Nazism, which is survival of the fittest. If you have power, exercise it. And any mercy, any compassion, any restraint on your exercise of power weakens the dominant force in the jungle.
And in any other world, justice and mercy would be considered virtues.
Well,
So
let's be clear. I think they're not only virtues, but they're the essence of civilization.
agree. Agree. And this goes back to the argument that what's going on now is not really just an attack on the Jews, but it is an attack on all Western civilization, and the ramifications are dire. Even for people who don't care about Jews. Now, in the current war in Gaza, honestly, the IDF soldiers are finding copies of Hitler's Mein Kampf in Arabic pretty much everywhere, in private homes, in the terror tunnels, even in schools and preschools. How much, so it sounds like there was some divergence perhaps back then, but how much do you think modern day radical Islamism borrows from Nazism, from Hitler?
Well, let's begin. Nazism showed a way. It showed a way, and it, like all radical ideologies, it has an attraction to radicals. And what one of the attempts of extremist Islam is to stop a little bit short of Nazism, but also one of the temptations of radical Islam, and that's not all Muslims and it's not all Muslim ideology. We're talking about radical, politicalized extremist Islam. One of their temptations and one of the things that they're engaged in doing is to, as it were, mimic Nazism, stopping short of the notion of the final solution. They can go anywhere, but not in our land.
Okay, so it sounds like there's a deliberate agenda to stop short, and yet at the same time, if you look at the attacks of radical Islam on Israel in particular, the goal is always maximum carnage. It's not necessarily the result because of the amazing defenses that Israel has in place. We could argue that they failed on 10/7. Nonetheless, so is that in order to, they have a huge propaganda mission to war to win over the sympathies of the world. When you say their goal, it sounds like their goal is to stop short of complete annihilation. Is that to keep them in the world? Good.
Well, let's be clear for a moment. There has been a modification of Hamas's charter, and the modification was to change the word Jew more or less to Zionist. We can go into details, but that's the basic thing, which is that they wanted to stop for Hitler, it was the Jew. For Hamas, it's the Zionist. There's an overlap of the whole of the thing, but their claim is we only want to get rid of the Zionists in Israel, and where they go, what they do, whether they go back to Poland, the United States, Australia, it doesn't matter. Now, let's be clear about one other thing. We're talking today in the middle of the Passover holiday. And the Passover holiday essentially celebrates the Jews coming out of Egypt and their journey into the desert, into the Promised Land. The Passover Seder concludes with the words next year in Jerusalem. And in that sense, it reinforces, dramatically reinforces the centrality of the land of Israel to Jewish aspiration and Jewish hope. So we were exiled from this land and we have returned. And consequently, it's not as if we're not an indigenous population. We are the original indigenous population that has survived into the 21st century, and we were prevented by the powers from being here, but the link to the land, the link to the place, the connection with an indigenous land is so central to this holiday that we feel it absolutely dramatically. It's also central to the Bible. And that is that this is the holiday that celebrates the biblical festival of Passover and the dramatic exodus from Egypt. And what we have to say at the beginning of the Passover Seder is now we are slaves. Next year we shall be free. Now we are in exile. Next year we shall be in the land of Israel.
And how long
has a poignancy when you say it here.
How long have we been saying that? Like, how long has that been in the Haggadah?
The Haggadah, we can tell when the Haggadah was compiled, but it was compiled after the year 135 of the Common Era. So the best way to say it is at least 1990, at least 1990 year, 1890 years is the best we can say we've been saying that, is not a short period of time in human history. Even I wasn't born then.
Right, and it's not like they started saying that in 1948 for all the people.
No.
They
started saying that in the year 135 of the Common Era. And we are now in 2025, so it's 1990 years,
so
at least.
Just to go on record. So let me ask your personal opinion, actually, about that, the changes that they made to the Hamas charter, because do you really think that was done in good faith, or do you think it was merely performative? Because I believe it was performative.
You know, let me say, I think it was mandatory for them to appeal to certain levels of support.
Right.
And that is, let's not call it either performative or authentic. Let's say it, call it what it is, which is politically necessary in order to position themselves in a better situation.
But did anything change in their ideology or their strategy?
Well, the very interesting thing is, let's look at, I'm a historian, so let's look at evidence. One of the things we had with Hamas, which is fascinating, is that they recorded their entire attack. And one of the people who recorded it essentially was conversing with his parents and said, "I've killed 10 Jews."
Exactly.
And he used the word Jews.
Right.
"You should be proud of your son, for he has killed, I have killed 10 Jews." So that type of vocabulary is a vocabulary of Jews, not Israelis, not Zionists, but Jews. And that says something. Now, is this man a spokesman for all of Hamas? Absolutely not. Is he the person they put in front of the cameras? No. But is this his sentiment at a moment of intense killing and the euphoria of that intense killing? Absolutely. Now, I've been meeting with former soldiers here who have fought in it. And one of the things that touches me each time is they are traumatized by two things. They're traumatized by their buddies who they have seen died, whom they have seen lost their lives, were they didn't die, they were killed. And they're also traumatized by the fact that they had to kill others. There's not a great deal of joy, and I'm talking about, ordinary soldiers, some of them my great nephews. It's not a great deal of joy in the fact that they have to fight a war and the like. And that's part of some of the morality amidst all of the destruction that you see in Israel. So I'm struck by that, and I'm struck by the fact that they don't celebrate the killing. At least many of them do not celebrate the killing.
Yeah, it's such an important distinction, and people are so morally confused right now between the concept of terror versus the concept of war. And soldiers do what they need to do to defend their country. Terrorists do what they want to do to destroy another country. And I want to just take the Islamic ideology one step further and point out that, like, one prominent and sort of unique aspect of both Islamism and Nazism versus every other form of racism is that they're not simply predicated on hate of the Jews, but actually complete annihilation. And I know it sounds like you and I disagree on that point to an extent, but what's so disturbing beyond that is that neither Hamas nor the Nazis stop at just massacring the Jews. Both of them have also go to great lengths to torture and humiliate them as well. Why?
Well, there's an interesting why I can give it to you in a very basic way. There's a book by the name of Gitta Sereny called Into Their Darkness. And Gitta Sereny interviewed a man who had been a commandant of one of the death camps. And she said, if you're going to kill these people, why did you torture them first? And he said something very profound, which I believe it made it easier. And that is that if you dehumanization in all genocides, dehumanization is a step to annihilation, to what they call extermination. So dehumanization, if you dehumanize a person, you say that they no longer share a common humanity with me. Therefore, if I have the right to exist and they don't share a common humanity, they don't have the right to exist, and consequently, killing them is easier. So dehumanization, we dehumanize them by language, we dehumanize them by behavior. The Nazis dehumanized the Jews even by the manner in which they violated their biological sensitivities, their biological necessities, making them ultimately, because they didn't have any other place to go, making them urinate and defecate in their own underwear and clothes. It was called by one philosopher excremental assault, making essentially making Auschwitz the anus mundi. Now, I don't know if I can use the word, but the anus mundi is the equivalent of the asshole of the universe. And they did that as a form because if somebody's like that, they're not like you and me who are neat and clean and, who put on fresh underwear every day and who shower and the like. They can't be human beings, they're animals. And that type of dehumanization, which is linguistic and cultural and every other way, makes killing much easier for the killer.
That's unbelievable. I've never heard that before. So in essence, what you're saying is that the dehumanization was more so that they could feel better about themselves than necessarily to make the Jews feel bad about themselves, that they were their own object of the humiliation, meaning that it was like a self-protective mechanism.
It's an inst it, look, it's an instinctive mechanism as well. We just we see it in every instance of genocide. We see it in other cases, for example, and there are also some religious differences. Tell you a story. Many years ago, I worked to train prison guards. And I found the difference in attitude between prison guards, between those who say, "There but for the grace of God go I." In other words, they looked at the prisoner and they said, "You know, if somebody hadn't straightened me out, my father hadn't, punished me when I was 13, or my priest hadn't reached out to me when I was 14 or 15, or if my coach hadn't set me out in the right path, I could have been like the prisoner."
Right.
And they ended up being interestingly compassionate guards. But if they said, "I'm unlike that person, there's nothing about him that is like me, they are the other," they ended up being compassionate guards. And consequently, it was the equivalent of some are saved and some are damned, they're damned.
It's the equivalent of
And it
someone.
was interesting. I had to get prison guards to begin to articulate this. How did they see that person? And that's after adjudication and legal responsibilities and everything else. So part of dehumanization involves making them so unlike us that their elimination seems perfectly normal or natural or easy, or even required.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense with the Nazis. So when it comes to Hamas, for example, let me give an example. Having Eli Shrabi on stage, having him looking like, sorry to make the parallel, a Holocaust survivor, and then asking him how excited he is to see his wife and children, not, they knew full well that they had already massacred them, but he did not know, and they took great joy in watching his reaction to the hope of seeing not the hope, the excitement of what he expected to see his family. I don't see that this is to dehumanize so that they can feel better about themselves. I feel like this
No, it's not only, look, it's not only they dehumanize about how they feel about themselves.
Let me just finish my thought really quickly. I feel as if perhaps a divergence between what the Nazi humiliation, based on what you're telling me, and the Hamas humiliation is that Hamas humiliation goes a step further and seeks to traumatize a nation beyond, because this person is being released.
Yeah, let me be clear. Dehumanization is a tool of self-protection because they become unlike us, but that's not to say that they don't singularly enjoy dehumanization because of their own ideology, and they don't enjoy torture. There's a dimension of sadism involved in that. There's a dimension of self-empowerment, watching the other person cringe. Clearly, part of what they were doing in the ceremonies of release was to essentially torture the entire country of Israel, because one of the very interesting things that Israel feels very deeply is that these are our people, they're part of our family. The Israeli ethic essentially is that we are all in this together. And I hear it on the radio every moment. There can be no joy until all of them are released. We can't stop now. We have to get the rest of them released. And it even goes not only to the living, but it goes to the dead, because there's a concept in Judaism of bringing a person to their proper grave. And the respect that that represents, because we treat the dead body with deep and profound respect. And consequently, we do that. That's saying that even the remnant of being human is entitled to the ultimate respect.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we could just take one moment to say all 59 hostages home. I don't know that there's, you know, a Jew in the world who cares about this issue. It doesn't pray every single day, every single night for all.
Well, you and I both wearing the necklace. It's not your most beautiful necklace, but it's a very important necklace. And the necklace, again, says, Halev Shelanu Shavui B'Gaza. My heart is imprisoned in Gaza. And it says, bring them home.
Right. Well, I just want to make a slight correction. Halev Shelanu is our heart. And it goes back to what you were saying, is that we all share one heart. This isn't Shelanu.
Right.
My heart, this is our heart. And
yeah.
And the tags, I think, are so important because they're so big and they're so conspicuous, and people ask me all the time, like, what is that? And I think that's part of the reason why it is so big, so that we can tell people and we could share and we could explain. It's amazing how many people do not know what happened on 10/7, do not know that there are still 59 hostages, have no context. They think that Israel invaded Gaza and that, like, is like that there's no such thing as Hamas. It's just Israel, like, as invaders, that there's nothing, there's no one on the other side. And people have to understand the complexity of what is going on right now. But we have to get the hostages home. So let me go back to these sort of the propaganda aspect, because it's playing such a important in detrimental role in this war. When you look at Hamas propaganda, it borrows very heavily and sometimes quite directly from Nazi propaganda. You'll see a lot of the exact same images, caricatures, and even like verbatim verbiage. Now, both of these heavily borrow from the Elders of Zion and rely on the fundamental concept of the Jewish people having an ages-old conspiracy to conquer and subjugate the world. Now, ironically, even as they are accusing the Jews of this secret imperialistic cabal, the ultimate stated goal of both Nazis and Islamists is actually to conquer the globe. I mean, this is the case with most of the accusations being levied against the Jews and the Jewish state today, a complete inversion of reality. Whatever Hamas and the Muslim world are guilty of, they blame on Israel and the Jews, and the masses believe and parrot every word they say. My question is this: why has anti-Semitic propaganda been so effective throughout history, even within the educated and well-meaning classes?
I want to step back and say I don't accept the word even in the well-educated, because, and everybody says the solution to the problem is education. And I begin to say that the decision to murder all the Jews and by gassing was coordinated on January 20th, 1942, by 15 men, and I'm gender specific, meeting in a beautiful villa in Wannsee, a lakeside area of Berlin. Eight of them had doctorates. So they were what we call in our Vietnam parlance, the best and the brightest.
Okay.
Now, and therefore, it's not education, it's a certain type of education an education that teaches compassion and decency and responsibility and the like. So that's just a minor point.
It's actually
Look.
your point. It's a very important point. It's funny because just the other day, somebody on my Facebook sent me this gobbledygook, like it just mental anti-Semitic gymnastics. And I made a comment how ridiculous it was. And then she sent me this huge paragraph giving me his credentials and how educated he was. And I'm like, that what does that prove? It doesn't.
Yeah, look, you can be a look, I believe in education. I'm educated. I got too many degrees to talk about, but the question becomes, again, what type of education, what does your education teach you? Now let's go back to the conspiracy theories. Basic text for this was something called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Protocols of the Elders of Zion was a Russian secret police forgery of a plagiarism of a novel done in France in the middle of the 19th century, and accused the Jews of having a secret cabal to control the world. And they called them the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And it coincided, ironically, with the first meeting of the Zionist Congress in 1897. So it was designed to say, the world is not as you see it. There's a secret group of people who are controlling it. There was a great scholar of Judaism, the late Daniel Biehl, who said something very wise. He said, Jews have never been as powerful as our enemies have accused us of being, nor as powerless, with the exception of the Holocaust primarily, as we have felt ourselves to be. And that is that the idea that Jews control the world, and you see it in all sorts of myths. You see it in the myth, Jews control Hollywood, Jews control the economy, Jews control the banks. Jews control the federal government. All of those things just are not true. If I were a profound Jewish partisan, I would say I wish I did control it. But if I did control it, it wouldn't look like this world. So the idea that Jews are all powerful is
A bad concept.
it's a profound myth. By the way, for those of who are listening to us, if you really want to learn about this, there is an absolutely fabulous, and you have to understand, I'm an intellectual snob, I read books. There's a fabulous graphic novel by a man by the Will Eisner, who is one of the great graphic novelists of the last generation, called The Plot. And if you want to read the Elder Protocol, I joke because the Protocols of the Elder Zion is a book that nobody's read, because
Okay.
if you read it, you fall asleep within the first 5 minutes. Great cure for insomnia. But everybody has, many people have internalized the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and imagine this mysterious cabal of Jews who control the world. And Will Eisner does a fabulous job, accessible to the entire world because it's a graphic novel, of showing you the history, the implications, the impact, and the refutation of that. The sad point is that the only language in which a refutation does not yet exist is in Arabic.
Of course.
And that's very important. There has been no publication refuting this in Arabic. And if I were advising the Arab population, I would say, look, don't exaggerate the power of the Jews. Understand it and understand where it is and what it is and what it is not, and understand who they are. Because I have to understand my enemy. They have to understand, if they regarded the Jews as the enemy, they have to understand their enemy. But if you exaggerate it, it becomes all sorts of, looming elements, and it's not good for you. It's not good for any side. But I recommend, and you have to know me well to understand that if I'm recommending a graphic novel, it must be very good.
I'm going to go ahead and link the references to sources that you've cited in the show notes after we're done. So including
The
the movie.
plot by Will Eisner.
I got it. I got The World Will Tremble and Into the Darkness, Into Their Darkness. I'll make sure to link those below. So I guess my question, and again, these are all just, of course, of your knowledge studies in a fair smattering of opinion. Do you think that these violent masses, okay, so I'm not talking about like within the Arabic world, I'm talking about in the Western world. Do you believe that these people truly believe like the murderous anti-Semitic rhetoric they're espousing, or is this like compliance as like more or less a Darwinian response to fit in and survive? And ultimately, like, which is a more socially threatening dynamic? Like, everybody believing we need to kill the Jews, or it doesn't even matter, we're going to go with the masses and chant along?
Look, the answer is some believe it, some don't believe it. And for some who don't believe it, it doesn't matter. And that is that one of the things that all these demonstrations have done is what it did for my generation. I'm a product of the civil rights movement. I marched in the civil rights movement. I'm a product of the Soviet Jewry movement. So I marched for a Soviet Jewry. That creates a sense of community and a sense of purpose. And it's interesting that there's a difference between the protest movements that are seeking to fight for and the protest movement that are seeking to fight against.
Right.
The protest movements that are seeking to fight for usually develop their own music. We
Okay.
shall overcome.
Right. Interesting.
They usually the Jewish res partisan resistance had an anthem. And the very interesting thing is the against developed phrases. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, all of that. But they haven't developed song.
Interesting.
And I just observed that. In fact, it just came to me because I remember deeply all of the anthems of the movements that I participated in years ago and, paid a price for that. I even have a scar on my back from participation in the civil rights movement, where I was beaten up. But having said that, there is a sense of community that's created. And given the isolation of this generation, there are some who went along with it, not because they so much believed it, as because they appreciated the community. And they also, there were, young men in my generation who said, well, that's where the women are. And therefore, you participate in that less out of noble reasons, though meeting a lovely young woman may be a very noble reason to participate in something, or the opposite, meeting a noble young man. But having said that, there's a sense of community and a sense of common purpose, which is part also. But it's clear that the leadership was an agitating leadership and knew exactly what it was doing and knew how to trigger it in a very real sense.
It's very interesting what you say about the music for two reasons. One is I have a whole playlist of music that has come out in the wake of 10/7. I would say most prominently being, of course, Edungalan's performance at Eurovision, John Andrasik's okay slash we are not okay song in Am Yisrael Chai, which is not the original version, but the new one that has become literally the modern national anthem of Israel. There's been quite a plethora of music and inspiration and art that has come out of the pro-Israel community. And yeah.
No, I was in synagogue Shabbat morning, Sabbath morning, and they did, and the Sabbath before Passover, and Passover had a very unique thing this year. It started on a Saturday night, and that only happens 12 times in a century, so it's a very rare experience. Next time it will happen is in 2045, for those of you who are dilettantes and want to know the story. But on the Sabbath before Passover, traditionally, the rabbi would give a major sermon. It was called the Shabbat HaGadol Drasha. Give a major sermon. And what was remarkable is the synagogue that I went to had no sermon, but they said that a number of synagogues were joining to hear the sermon of the woman who has become the voice, as it were, of this war. And of the anguish of the survivors, which is Rachel Goldberg Polin. So here you had and I a traditional congregation that was suspending their own speech to hear from the voice of that generation. And in fact, at our Seder, we read some of her poetry. And you have to feel the compassion in her poetry, and also the I'm using primitive, not pejoratively, but as the most basic existential values we live, the woman who is fighting, the lion is fighting for the cub, the woman who is fighting for her son, and all of these hostages are her sons and daughters. And it was exceedingly moving to hear that what the congregation was going to do was to listen to the poetess and the voice of compassion in this war, who had paid the ultimate price with the loss of her son, Hirsch. So a palatable powerfulness to the
Yeah.
experience.
Yeah, she has certainly been a rock of our community for the last 18 months. So I do want to get back to sort of the propaganda, the world reaction, et cetera. And I want to talk about how in the immediate aftermath of 10/7, Israel actually did have the world's sympathy for about a minute, maybe a little
We
less,
have
but
to be clear. We have to be clear about that because there's a movie out now called 10/8,
no, I saw it. It's
and
important.
the movie 10/8 makes a very interesting point that the anti-Israel protests on campus
Yes.
began 2 weeks before Israel had taken any response to the war in to the attack in Gaza. And the attack from Gaza. So it was there before Israel had done anything when seemingly Israel had the sympathy of the world because of its victimization. And one woman by the name of Dara Horn has published a book called The World Loves Dead Jews. And that is on victimization. But the response took place even before Israel responded.
Sure.
Which tells us something. And somebody asked me at the screening, why did it call, say 10/8 and why was that important? And the importance of that is it preceded any action by Israel.
Course. Of course. And every single person who's in this fight knew that global sympathy was going to turn on Israel within weeks. I mean, you didn't have to be a scholar to know that. You just have to have been paying attention for the last 10 or 20 years. But nobody I've talked to and nobody I've heard anticipated it would happen like within minutes or hours. Did you think it was going to turn that fast? I know you're saying that there, I mean, listen, there's been anti-Semitism on campus in these marches for years. Forget about 2 weeks before. There's a lot of implications that Students for Justice in Palestine knew about 10/7 before 10/7, as evidenced by the reactivation of their Columbia Instagram page 3 minutes before the attacks. So I don't think that's really the question, but did you think public opinion was
Yeah, I really don't know that. I can't say.
my question is just did you like how quickly after that when you saw 10/7 on TV, did you think, okay, we're gonna have sympathy for a day, a week, a year, a month? Like what did you how fast did you think the world was gonna turn?
I did not think it was going to turn as radically as it turned. And I underestimated the venom. And I underestimated the coordination, and I underestimated the pull that was there. And I'm supposed to be a pretty good student of anti-Semitism. So I was plain wrong. And in one sense, I've been playing catch up ever since to my understanding of that. So I thought it might last for a while. The other thing we have to say, which is important to emphasize, is that people lose sight of the fact that the Palestinians had agency and have agency. In other words, they made certain decisions, and those decisions have implications. Anybody who did who planned 10/7, the scope of those attacks, had to know what the response was going to be and had to understand that the response would be massive and decisive, and Israel would be trying to reestablish its deterrent principle. So they had to make that decision. And in fact, we see some evidence of the fact in the protest movements that have developed in Gaza. Now that there's been a weakening of the rule of Hamas, and people are saying, look at what you've achieved, and this is the devastation, because anybody could have predicted that was the way Israel was going to respond. But we speak of Palestinian state. Palestinian state could have been achieved in 37, could have been achieved in 48, could have been achieved in 67 when King Hussein of Jordan was asked not to invade. Could have been achieved in 2000 with the agreement that Bill Clinton negotiated, which Arafat then backed out of. Could have been achieved in 2008 with the offer of Ehud Olmert. So the notion of a Palestinian state imagines that the Palestinians haven't made choices along the way. And they've made bad choices along the way, not understanding that Israel is here to stay and has proved that its population, and I'm here, and the population is interesting because they are willing to fight for their country despite the fact that they hate their government. But they love the way in which they live and the community that they have, and their life in this country. So in that sense, it's extraordinary to see what's happening. But the Palestinians have agency. They've misexercised the agency. And again, it's predictable what's going to happen.
Right.
It's thoroughly predictable, and then the world acts as if it's surprised by it to begin with.
Well, I think that if we go back a few decades, we after 9/11, we could see the Western world marching like zombies deeper and deeper into this Philo-Islamism. I don't know what to call it. Like adding, everything was about, okay, well, let's put burqas or whatever they're called on the modeling runways, and let's make sure that we can build a mosque on the 10/7, on sorry, on the 9/11 disaster site. And like it was just like it was just such a far swing to be like, okay, let's take care of this. Let's start honoring the people who just set out to, murder thousands of Americans. And I think that march towards this appreciation of radical Islam started on 9/11 and culminated on 10/7.
I'm not sure about that. Look, I thought that people who opposed the building of an Islamic center near the 9/11 memorial didn't understand the impact of the 9/11 memorial, and that is, I know something a little bit something about memorials and their power. It was not going to stand as counter presence to the overwhelming presence of it. And in the United States, we have the idea that freedom of religion means the freedom to create a community center. So I was one of the Jews who said that this is not something we should oppose and the like. Look, our up and I thought George W. Bush deserved enormous credit for saying it was a battle against radical Islamic ideology and not against Islam. And that is that there are multiple forms of Islam, and one of the forms is a radical Islamic ideology that is lethal, first of all, to the Muslims, lethal to the Western world, and lethal to the Jews. That's different than Islam. And it's also different than also confronting the reality of the fact that Israel is here. Israel is going to continue to exist. And any imagination that you're going to destroy it, any idea that you're going to destroy it, is an imagination that is a false perception of reality. I think we're seeing that now in Lebanon, with the diminished power of Hezbollah, and we'll see what the end result is going to be in Gaza. But the reality is that Israel is here to stay, and it's not about to go out of business, and they've shown that in their response as a nation. And the slogan here that we hear all over the place is the people of Israel are better than its government, and they're determined to protect themselves and to create for themselves a living, viable society. And they've been traumatized by the events of 10/7, and traumatized also by the events after 10/7, by the vehemence of the anti-Israel response. That's why they appreciate visits. That's why they appreciate solidarity. And that's why, some of our presence here is very, very important.
Agree. Okay. I agree. And I've actually was there twice last year. I'll be going again in a couple of months. But I do want to, since we have you, the foremost Holocaust expert on earth, or one of them. I know that that's sometimes uncomfortably called foremost. But I do want to focus on your expertise as a Holocaust scholar in order to really gain some insight into what's going on and why. So getting back to these anti-Semitic mobs, and they are, yes, there are some who just want to see protection of the children of Gaza. I get that, but they're also chanting for death to Jews. They're also chanting for death to Israel. They're also calling for jihad. This is not They're not mincing words. And again, this started October 7th, October 8th, and anyone paying attention was instantly struck with the answer to the decades-old question of how the Holocaust could have ever happened in the first place. Started with a few rogue professors and demonstrations, and it grew a little bit every day, just boiling the frog until systemic anti-Semitism has been completely normalized and even aggrandized across Western civil society. Obviously, the groundwork was actually laid decades ago, and Islamists, now, when I say Islamists, as you say, I'm referring to radical Islam, have been patiently and painstakingly sowing these seeds, waiting for just the right moment to create a groundswell. How does this compare with the process of normalization of Jew hatred that took place in Nazi Germany?
Look, let's begin by saying, and I always make this point, there's no equivalent. But when you and I were in high school, and in my case, in the last century, you may be last week, when we were in high school, we got many essays called Compare and Contrast. And let's begin. This is not the Holocaust. Holocaust ultimately occurred over 12 years in a sustained period by the most powerful nation in Europe. It went over 22 countries, and it resulted in the murder of 6 million Jews and a whole range of victims. This is something else. The venom may be the same. The power is not the same because Jews have the capacity to respond, and because this is not a phenomenon that is in control of a nation state of enormous power. And Germany was a nation state of enormous power that once controlled virtually the entire continent of Europe, almost to the gates of Moscow and the edge of the English Channel. So you can't compare the two in terms of magnitude, sustainability, etc. You can compare the venom, and you can say, is this the 1920s? Is it the early 1930s? Is this an indication of a malaise? I have always taught that Jews are sometimes the equivalent of a canary in the mine. And that is that if you look at an attack, why the canary? Canary is in the mine because if there's a loss of oxygen and the canary starts squealing, then the miners know to get the hell out. The reality is, if you see a society that's attacking its Jews, you understand, and a world that's attacking its Jews, you understand that there's a deep malaise. You have a different reality now, which is that Israel is not weak but strong, and we have the reservoir of the ability to respond. And that's radically different than what we had in Europe. And it's the reason that we can't minimize our power. And we can't minimize the way in which we can respond. The hatred may be similar. The venom is certainly similar. The gang warfare is similar. And we have to worry about the fragility of democracy. But while all this is taking place, we still have the results of the Abraham Accords. And we also have a drawing closer of Israel and Saudi Arabia, which used to be the greatest supporter of radical Islam, not because Saudi Arabia likes Israel, but because Saudi Arabia sees Israel as a reliable adversary to Iran. And there have been some good things that have resulted from this, including the possibility that the Lebanese army and the Lebanese government will be able to control its territory. So all of this is taking place. That is the compare and contrast part of it.
Sure.
But this is clearly not the Holocaust.
Yeah, no, my question was this process of normalization of Jew hatred that has gone on in the past few years in the Western world, how does that parallel? How did Hitler it convince his nation that Jew hatred was a virtuous and worthwhile prospect?
Need another hour to answer that question. Basically, look, he built on anti-Semitism and he created a nation of grievance. And the basic element of it is that Hitler himself, and let me put it to you this way, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Adolf Hitler came to power at the same time. Hitler on January 30th, 1933, Roosevelt on March 4th, 1933. In those days, inauguration was March 4th, not January 20th. The difference between them, both of them faced 25% unemployment rate and a 40% collapse of GDP. The difference between them is that Hitler turned the nation one against the other, and Roosevelt turned the nation one toward each other. And that is an incredible element. We live in a pluralistic world, and if we turn against each other, we end up with violence and all sorts of horrific evil. If we turn toward each other, we have enrichment of diversity and plurality and a celebration of the wide variety of our common humanity that is absolutely essential. Calling all the Jews to blame for it or reading them out or violence like that, this is what we call demonization, delegitimation, and destruction. And that's a symptom of a very sick world.
How was the pump primed?
Pump primed was by lies, by venom, by grievance, by anger, by fury, and by force.
So exactly the same as what's going on in Gaza. I would classify all those.
I don't, again, it's not the same because Gaza is now Hamas is a virtually defeated entity. And Hamas is a shattered universe. So, and Gaza is a shattered universe. That's a radically different world. I mean,
I'm just talking about the elements of radicalization. I'm just talking about what.
I think the elements of radicalization are there, and the question becomes whether the consequences of defeat will seep in. And that is that let's take the protest, which are the glimpse of the fact that it is inevitable if you attacked Israel like that and you didn't destroy Israel, and nobody imagined they had the power to destroy Israel, Israel would respond. And once it responded, the response would be overwhelming and the response would be lethal. And one could have predicted that. So I think people are waking up. It's not that they're liking Israel. It's not that they're liking Jews. It's not that they're liking anybody, but they're seeing that path as a path of destruction. There has to be a different path that is to be taken. What that path is, we can argue about for a very long time, but that's a path of destruction.
Okay.
And
Another.
it's a sad path of destruction.
Absolutely. Another thing that the Nazis and radical Islam have in common is that they both say that Jews are basically the reason for all the problems in the world, which is it's sort of an offshoot of what you were saying before about controlling all of the world. So for centuries, like if not millennia, the
Well,
Jews.
but again, that is such a ridiculous proposition in the Arab world. I mean, it's such a ridiculous proposition in the Muslim world and the Arab world. Let's take a simple example. Is one of Israel's neighbors is Syria. Syria has experienced the murder of 5 million, 500,000 people, and the refugee situation of a couple of million more people. Israel had almost nothing to do with that. All of that was an inner battle. The battle between the Shiite and the Sunni within Islam is a grand battle of Shiite and Sunni. The battle within Lebanon was a battle of multiple forces, including Hezbollah, including the Christians and the Muslims and the Palestinians and all of that. The idea that Israel is the sole, the largest, the only, all of that is such a wonderfully dangerous misperception of reality that it's a path of it's a path to a dead end for those who believe it.
I completely agree. And while we have been the world's scapegoats for every imaginable societal ill, I guess like my next question is like, so why the Jews and why does the world need scapegoats? Why do they have to blame everything on anyone?
Well, part of that is because people don't want to accept responsibility for themselves. Part of that is people are aggrieved. And part of that is that they don't have, look, we're living in a multi-complex world, and people still want a simple solution. And a simple solution is not in the cards. We're in multiple transitions. We can go into this, but let me give you a very simple thing. We're in transition from an industrial-based economy to a knowledge-based economy. We have people who have been the victims of that because they were trained for one world that did not exist. When I speak to college students, and I've been honored at graduations to be the speaker, I have one theme, which is the most important thing you can get out of your education is your capacity to learn. Because most of us will be working with tools that do not exist in fields that do not exist at this moment. And those of us who have the confidence that we can learn will what? Will be able to thrive in that world, provided that we do learn. You and I are now talking on Zoom. We're talking continent away. 5 years ago, 7 years ago, this didn't exist. The transition to the power of podcast didn't exist. You had mainstream media or nothing. So we're all living in a changing world, and some people want to hold back that change. Some people want to say, okay, somebody's controlling the change, and our change is going to be even more dramatically rapid with artificial intelligence and robotics, that the idea of blaming one group of that is not only false, but it's to distort reality at your own peril.
Absolutely. I might argue that it's not going to be dependent on our capacity to learn so much as our capacity to think, because indoctrination is a form of learning, and we're seeing how detrimental that has been. What I see is a generation of young people who are not being taught to think for themselves, but rather to just learn.
Okay.
That being said, let's get into something that's very near and dear to your heart. How much do you think, speaking of learning, a lack of Holocaust education is at fault for the extraordinary resurgence of anti-Semitism across the globe today?
Well, you're asking an incredible question, which everybody who is teaching the Holocaust is asking. We're asking whether it's lack of education or misplaced education, or whether we have to sharpen our tools and grapple with it. I've been writing on this considerably, and I've been sharing it with my colleagues. And I think that Holocaust education is not the solution for all. And it's not only that, for some, it teaches what to do in terms of sharpening the hatred. I taught for many years at Georgetown, and I was always worried that there was somebody in the back of the room who was the son, or maybe even these days, the daughter of a despotic ruler in one of these countries, who was taking notes and saying, okay, the Germans did that. Birnbaum says the Germans did that wrong. When I get to power, I won't do that. I won't engage in a two-front warfare, namely invade the Soviet Union and invade Western Europe. There are a variety of things that somebody could learn that were there. I think Holocaust education has to now introduce people to the Jews, who we are, and how complex Jewish identity is. It has to deal very much with the years 1919 to 1933, which is how democratic society becomes authoritarian and ultimately totalitarian. It must deal with anti-Semitism in a very basic way, including the notion of conspiracy theories, so that we deal with your question, why the Jews? And how can you come to this? Must deal with propaganda, must deal with the great lie, and must deal with the temptation to an all-powerful totalitarian society. Must deal with the question of grievances and lost and scapegoats. I mean, it's got all sorts of themes that it must deal with, and must deal with it a little bit better. We're gonna have to be mindful of time because I am here with my family, and we have a family dinner in about 14 minutes that I must show up at, because
You don't even have to finish that sentence because it's a family dinner. Got it.
it's a family dinner.
I literally just skipped right to my last question. I have it queued up and ready to go so we could wrap up. And thank you so much for the generosity of your time. So you could keep this as brief as you wish. What lesson or lessons do you think humanity needs to learn from both the Holocaust and the Israel-Hamas war in order to move in a positive and productive direction into the future?
We have to learn essentially to celebrate the diversity of the humanity and the innate value of every human being. And if we do that, and we say we are in this together, and the like, we can still make a better world. And one of the things that pains me is I'm ashamed of the world that we have today. And when I lecture to students, I'm saying, I thought we would have bequeathed you a better world. And we have not. But my essential lesson is that and my essential point is we need to celebrate human dignity, human decency, human diversity, and live in a society which believes that all of us have something to contribute to its ultimate betterment and improvement.
Amen. And thank you for your vast contributions to literally humanity, and the whole entire world needs to hear the lessons that you are teaching so eloquently and brilliantly. So thank you
Thank you.
so much. Chag Sameach. Enjoy the
Alex Smith.
family, and thank you once again for joining me.
Take care. Bye-bye.